Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
Hey everybody, welcome to Introducing Gamers to Pathfinder. Pathfinder can be a little bit intimidating for people who've never played a D20 RPG, just because it's a kind of high barrier to entry. There's a lot to learn, so we're going to talk about making that a little easier for newcomers. I'm Jessica Price, I'm the project manager at Paizo.
And I'm Linda Zayas-Palmer, I develop for the Pathfinder Society Blind.
So the first thing when you've got new people is it's often really helpful to find a point of reference and explain from there what they're actually doing here. If they've seen Lord of the Rings, you know, obviously that is a story that has a structure that is pretty similar to, you know, kind of the classic D20 adventuring story. You have an adventuring party, they have a goal, they work together to achieve it, they have different skills. But, you know, books, video games, anything that has sort of a similar structure can be really useful. And, I mean, a lot of people these days, if they don't know what Pathfinder is, they know what D&D is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, every so often you encounter a unicorn out there in the wild who's never heard of it, and it can be helpful to have a good analogy. Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, just even something like Harry Potter, everybody's heard of Harry Potter. You've got a world and it has magic and all sorts of interesting things that can happen.
You have to be careful with that one, though, because I once ran a game for an entire group of new people and that started at a magic school. And so I was like, yeah, you know, it's going to be a little Harry Potter-like, but that was just supposed to be like the home base and where they started from. Mm-hmm. And 13 sessions later, they were still making me role-play taking classes with them. It took me forever to actually get them out the door, so, you know.
So maybe don't use that one, then.
Well, I mean,
that has experience.
That's what you want to do, but, yeah. And so then, also, don't overcomplicate the explanation. You know, if you try and explain the whole core rulebook to them, they're probably going to run screaming, if that's, you know, your first session. Mm-hmm. So, I find it helpful to explain that D20 RPGs have two main modes, basically, a sort of collaborative storytelling role-playing mode, and in which the GM sets the scene, plays all the supporting characters, and a combat-focused mode in which you roll dice to determine whether you succeed at something. Obviously, it's not just combat, but since their first dice rolling is a lot of times a combat, it's helpful to kind of divide up how they're thinking about it, too. There's going to be a lot of talking, and then there's going to be some dice rolling.
And in terms of sort of how does this work, rather than launching into the whole explanation of, like, well, you know, you have these 20 skills, and you have these things, and you can make these 17 different kinds of attacks, and you have all these kinds of things, it can be useful to just sort of ask, like, describe the room, describe the situation, ask them, well, what is it that you want to do? Like, do they want to jump up and swing from the chandelier? Do they want to run around and try to find, like, okay, well, you know, there's a torch over there. Can I take it down? Can I set something in the room on fire? Whatever kinds of things they come up with. Because one of the really great things about new players is they don't have sort of that entrenched sense of system that experienced players have where they're like, well, in this situation, this is the optimal thing to do. So they come up with all sorts of great creative ideas that can lead to really memorable moments at the table. So as the GM, you know, you have a lot of freedom to say, okay, yes, that we can work with that. How is that going to work? You know, either like, you know, a few useful tools there are, you know, just defaulting to a basic ability check, or just giving a circumstance bonus for whatever cool stuff they come up with. And especially like with a new player who might be feeling kind of like, okay, well, I'm not really sure if I can contribute to this. A little out of sorts. I know that's how I felt as a new player starting out. Being able to come up with something cool that really helps the table is something that becomes really memorable and can help convince that new player to stick around.
Along those lines, remember the rules are a tool set and not a straitjacket. It's sort of because the game can be really simulationist, and because if you want rules, we have rules for practically everything. You sort of run into what I like to call the Ninth Amendment problem, which is, I narrowly escaped becoming a lawyer, so. In constitutional law, the more case law you read, the more you discover that justices don't know what to do with the Ninth Amendment, which just says, that if there are any rights that haven't been enumerated in the Bill of Rights, that doesn't mean that you don't have them. No judge knows what to do with that, so they all avoid it. And so it can, you know, like, we can get into that mindset where if there aren't rules for it, you can't do it. You can do anything you want. And like Linda was saying, a lot of times new players have a really fresh way of looking at it because they don't know what the limits are. Like the first time I played a D20 game, I was playing a rogue, and we go into this barn that I think the GM did not want us to go into. Like, he kind of offhand mentioned there was a barn there, and I'm like, oh, let's go check that out. Maybe there are horses. And so we go in, and he's like, yeah, there's an ogre in there, and he seems like he woke him up. And I think that was, you know, so all the other party members who'd all been playing D&D for a long time were like, we got to get out of here. We're first level. We're not equipped to take on an ogre. Like, and I'm like, well, what do you mean? And they're like, he's got to be at least the equivalent of like a fourth level character. And I'm like, I took use rope. If we tie him up and he's on the ground, what level is he then? And they're all like, well, that's not really how that works. But I'm like, but we could like lasso him, right? And the GM's like, sure. But he found a way to do it. And it ended up being really fun and really funny. So. Also, the flip side of that is remember that structure can be really comforting for people who aren't sure about what they're supposed to be doing. Don't force people to roleplay. You know, like, a lot of people aren't comfortable with it. And a lot of people especially aren't comfortable with it at first. You know, they're like, what is my relationship to this character? When I talk, am I supposed to say my character says, or am I supposed to just say it? So, you know, giving people prompts can be really helpful. Giving them small, self-contained opportunities to roleplay, you know, sort of being like, you know, if they're like, yeah, I want to try and convince them, you know, just prompting them and being like, okay, well, what do you say to the guy?
And, you know, if they're not comfortable saying, like, exactly what words they say, one phrase that I found works pretty well is, like, what kind of argument that you do want to make? What kind of points do you want to make? Especially when someone comes in new with that high charisma character, and they're like, oh, gosh, I'm supposed to be the brilliant orator, and I don't know what I'm doing. So it's like, well, I just want to bring up these kinds of things. And then it's like, okay, so you say it, it sounds really good, and you can sort of help them come up with a phrasing too if you want to. But that way you have something to work off of. One other thing, like, we do when you're doing society, there is a little more structure to how the rules work, but the creative solutions clause in the guide is still very important to sort of allow that flexibility, particularly for the new players.
And if your players really aren't taking the initiative and don't seem comfortable, you can always default to giving them binary choices, like, would you like to do this or would you like to do this? You know, I don't generally recommend it. I generally prefer open-ended questions, but if they're really not engaging, having only two options kind of, you know, prevents that option paralysis.
And that can happen in games with more experienced players too. You know, the thing where it's like, do we go to the castle first or do we go to the town first? And the players debate it for like 20 minutes and it's like, all right, guys, show of hands. Who says castle? Who says town? All right, let's go.
So those sort of prompts can be super useful. Also, feel free to treat skills as passive so that people don't get overwhelmed. So if somebody has, like, when I'm playing with new players, I ask them to write down all their knowledge skills and whatever the bonus is for it on a card for me, so that I can look at a card and be like, okay, Julie, like, you know, your character has knowledge local, so you recognize the sigil on that woman's brooch, and you know that she's a duchess. So you don't always have to ask them to roll, because especially for new players, like, rolling can be really fun, dice are fun, chance is fun, but if you're asking them to do it for everything, it can start to feel really mechanical and not have, you know, that sort of fluidity and that feel of a story rather than a numerical
thing. Another nice thing about making sure you're familiar with that new player's character is you can become familiar with those points in which their character was going to shine and be the one at the table who's going to be able to do the thing. And if you have the chance to have a situation where they're going to be the star, that's always good.
Yeah. It's also really fun when the game recognizes the work that you put into developing your character. So, like, if as a GM you ask your character or your players to create backstories for their characters, try and incorporate that. Like, instead of having a random NPC show up and give them information, if your character mentions that, you know, they went to this particular university, have it be, you know, another alumnus of that university that, like, recognizes something about them and is like, oh, hey. Or, you know, if they mention they have a fraught relationship with their family, or they've been disowned or something like that, if you have a character where you want it to be difficult for them to get information or to form a relationship with this character, maybe have it be a cousin of theirs. You know, the sheriff in this town is a cousin of theirs and was like, oh yeah, I'm not supposed to talk to you, you know.
Yeah, and if you're, when you're running a structured game like a Pathfinder Society game, you can still find ways to bring in that information about the character. Like if that character has key things about them, about, you know, interesting things that they wear or interesting things that they say or things like that, having the NPCs respond to them. And if you have a group of players that often plays together at a venue or whatever, then you can really start to build up the mythology. One of the things that I like to do a lot back in when I lived in Boston for a while is we have, like, the characters would hear about the exploits of each other. So, like, if someone did something really dramatic, then, like, there was one PC who got into terrible trouble and got himself banned from Kadira for his behavior.
Totally deserved it.
So then in later adventures, like, and his PC's name was Applemont. So later adventures, people will be like, okay, we're not sending Applemont on this one. We're sending you, don't mention Applemont, okay, guys? So, like, you can still tie that in.
I think who here has watched Firefly? Okay, right? So the Man They Call Jane song, right? If you have a moment like that, it's super fun and can be funny. Especially if it is sort of a mixed, you know, like, they're famous but not necessarily for a good thing. Or, like, because they're famous, everybody's expecting them to be a hero. That's especially useful when you have, like, lawful, stubborn characters that won't, you know, especially, like, people often play neutral as, like, really self-interested, and you have that one player who's like, well, you know, why should I help these people? What's in it for me? Putting, you know, I mean, like, always you can bribe them. You can be like, oh, well, if you do it, you'll get a magic item. But you can also use social pressures. Like, you walk into this town and everybody recognizes you and thinks you're a hero, and, you know, children are clinging to the hem of your
neck. I heard you're going to help us. I'm so happy.
Yes. Oh, please, sir, finally I'll get to have a blanket. So, you know, guilt.
Watch the person know that. So, in terms of when you're considering the some more of the complicated mechanics in the game, particularly when you're playing in a home game, you don't necessarily need to get into all the nitty gritty details. Like, you don't necessarily need to make sure you're going properly down every. Have you seen the graphic representation of, like, how does grapple work? There's charts where it's like the flow chart. Start here, go here, go here, go here.
Yeah, that one kind of those stuff, flow, like, charts. Print it out. It takes up, like, four sheets of tabloid size paper.
Yeah, it's just like when you have those more complicated things, you can kind of simplify that down.
Yeah, and it's a way to keep the game moving too, because, like, you know, for new players, like, if you are super into combat and you have optimized your character and you want a chance to use this particular feat and whatever, the fact that combat is slow while people look up edge cases may not matter to you, but a lot of times for new players, if everybody's sitting there looking up, you know, trying to find something in the core rule book, that can slow it down enough and that can be really alienating. So feel free to just, like, I mean, it surprises me how rarely the game actually formally uses your ability score bonus, right? Like, we use it for building your character, but we don't tend to do just, like, straight up dex checks that often. But if something's really complicated and you don't want to, and you don't know where it is in the book, feel free to just use an ability score check. Be like, roll me a strength check, roll me a dex check. It is a rule you do not have to look up. And similarly, like, don't be afraid to break the rules. Like, so playing on God mode all the time isn't fun. But giving your characters 30 seconds of God mode can be really fun and can be something that they remember for years. Like, one time, my characters, I had them fighting a Bebeleth, and they were low level. It was a wounded Bebeleth, but they didn't know that. But I'd left an orb of dragonkind in the room, but it was like, this thing is broken, you pick it up, you don't know what it is. And so it was like, whoever picks this up is going to get to be a dragon, but only for like 3 rounds. So one of my players picked it up, and it was perfect because he was the guy that won, loved puns, and it was a copper dragon orb, so it was really fortuitous. And so he, you know, he picks it up and touches it, and I took him out in the hall and like gave him his new dragon character sheet, and was like, "And here's your mini." And like, he still, like 8 years later, is like, "Remember that time I was a dragon for 30 seconds? That was amazing." And he's like, "Yep." So, use it sparingly, but it can be really fun.
Yeah. So when you're introducing new players, another thing on top of like making sure that you don't bog down with explanations and things like that is to make sure that you aren't playing the game for them. So there can sort of be this temptation to be like, oh yeah, and you can do this, or you can do this, or you could do this, or especially if you start to get into like, oh well, you do this, and then I do this, and whatever. It's good to balance prompts with open-ended questions like, what would you like to accomplish this turn? And this also goes for, as a GM, making sure that other players at the table aren't doing the whole explaining thing. It's a pretty common thing if you have a couple or a group of friends who come in and one of them is like, you know, so like she comes into the game and like her husband's new to the game and she's like, oh, well, here you go. Like, this is how you play. And it's like, okay, well, we need to make sure that the new player is getting to make decisions for themselves.
Yeah, don't explain something unless somebody asks. Like, don't just jump in with an explanation, because if they know, it can be really, really frustrating. One of the first times I played, the other players at the table were like adding up my bonuses and my dice rolls for me. And I'm like, yeah, I can do math. In fact, I'm pretty sure I'm better at math than you are, because you did not add that correctly. So.
Yeah.
So yeah. Just kind of as a general rule, you know, what we're doing here is collaborative storytelling. It is interactive storytelling. There is a rule from improvisatory theater that's useful here, which is the yes and rule, which is if two actors are doing an improv scene together and one of them asserts something about the reality of the scene, you don't be like, no, that's not true. If you want to change it or if you want to redirect it or whatever, you say yes and. So if a guy is, you know, if you're one of your partners in the scene, like goes over and is pretending to like wash dishes, you don't be like, there's no sink there, you're not washing dishes, right? If you want to change the scene, you know, you're like, you take the dish towel from him and be like, you know, come over here. So it's similar in RPGs. You know, somebody, obviously, as the GM, you have to have a certain amount of control over what's in the scene. You can't let them be like, yes, and then I pull out my +5 sword. But, you know, if they're trying to go a particular direction with the way they're role-playing, if they're taking a particular approach to interacting with NPCs, don't negate that. Like, work with it. If you don't like it, just try and gently redirect it rather than being like, no.
You know, and a parallel to this sort of is... If you have something that, so we have a rule in Development for Pathfinder Society. It's basically like, don't make the thing impossible. If you want to make it hard, you can put in the hard VC, but don't make it impossible. So that the people can still succeed, even if it's not necessarily like where we would expect the story to go.
And you get to define what succeeding is. So, you know, when we say don't, you know, don't make the DC impossible. I know that a lot of times there's a temptation. It's like, well, if they get the answer that they're looking for, that is supposed to be, you know, the whole point of their quest is to find this answer. And step one, they, you know, manage to interpret the uninterpretable script and just get it. It's like, who's seen The Thing? John Carpenter's The Thing? Yeah, so it's a horror movie, right? The fact that it's an alien that can jump bodies is like a major twist that creates the suspense. But at the very beginning of the movie, there are these Norwegians that come running up to the main characters and are yelling in Norwegian. If you understand Norwegian, it gives away the entire plot of the movie. So, you know, there's times where you don't want that to happen. But remember, you get to define what success is. So, like, if, you know, you have the script that it's supposed to take them, you know, half the adventure to get the information to interpret it, and they make a linguistics check, and they roll it at 20, consider changing what it actually says to be, like, more enigmatic so that there's other information that they have to get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are we on?
Number 10.
Oh! Really important one. Be mindful of people's comfort levels. This is supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be collaborative. It's supposed to be cooperative. And you don't always know what people's comfort levels are, but I usually go by the rule of playing by the lowest comfort denominator. So if there's somebody who gets really uncomfortable at, like, graphic descriptions of violence, maybe don't describe in detail what happens when somebody runs their sword through somebody else's torso, right? I mean, if your players are into it, that's cool. If there's a way to make it funny and not graphic, and you want, like, some sort of detail, you can do that. But, you know, if somebody's uncomfortable, if somebody's visibly uncomfortable, obviously stop what you're doing and change what you're doing. But even, you know, it's good to check in with your players every so often, every few sessions, and be like, how's it going? You know, what do you like? I like to do it by email, so if somebody doesn't want to, like, hurt someone else's feelings or doesn't want to be the stick in the mud who doesn't enjoy something, they can tell it to you in private. There are also, you know, for if you're going to be playing games with more mature themes, there are a bunch of safety mechanisms like the X card, which is basically a card somebody can throw out that is like, okay, stop what we're doing. You know, if you Google, there's probably like 10 different systems at this point with varying levels of, like, a lot of them distinguish between, like, okay, I'm fine with how far this has gone, but I don't want it to go any farther. So, like, here's a line, let's curve away from that. And some of them are like, stop right now.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, it doesn't always have to be that dramatic. It's also just like, if somebody's not comfortable role-playing, don't force them to. Different people have different play styles, comfort levels.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so like in whenever you're doing a home game with friends that you've known for a while, then you can kind of suss that out a lot more easily with what's going to be appropriate for them. And if you're with new people, then, you know, sort of assuming like, okay, let's not bring out that more questionable stuff until we get to know them more and see if that's gonna work out well. Another thing for starting out. If it's possible to start new players at level 1 or close to it, that's always good. The less complexity in that regard, the better. My first ever game, I jumped in as a 7th level character and was horribly confused for a little while. We kind of had an ongoing joke about how I forgot one of my major powers every single session, but I told people not to remind me because I wanted to learn it and they respected that. But it was sort of like, I forgot that I had that healing ability. Oh no, I could have used that. That would have helped. So yeah, if you can start at level 1, that's useful. Running a published or a custom introductory adventure is a good starting point. And it's also, you can consider offering the new player a pre-generated character to start out with, and then let them change it out as they go along. It's also good, like, at that first level, if they want to change things out. You can always rebuild your character until you're done with the whole first level thing and you play them at a second level higher thing in Pathfinder Society. And that's good for home games as well. Like, if they start playing something, they're like, yeah, I don't really know if I like how this works. Like, there's no reason to be like, you're stuck with this character for the next 2 years of this campaign. It can be like, okay, no, you know, you want to change out those feats? Sure, like, let's have a scene where you go to, like, a sword master and you train and you figure it out. So, you know, it's, The point is to all get together and have a good time.
And it can be, the more we play Pathfinder, the more we can forget the, like, joys of first level. You know, like, we know what's coming, we know what the options when you get to third level are, so there's a tendency, if you've been playing for a while, to treat first level as something that you just have to, like, get through. It can be really fun, especially for people who are playing for the first time and don't know what's going on, because, you know, it's like, I'm a first level character and I see a kobold with a crossbow. I'm going to hide behind the nearest rock, which is exactly what I would do in real life. You know, so there's that, first level characters are easier in some ways to connect with, because like none of us are 7th level wizards, right? If any of us learned magic today, it sure would be like, I can make my finger glow!
That's so cool!
So, you know, try and I mean, it's one of the reasons that I love playing with people who've never played before, because they do have that sort of delight in like, oh, look what I can do. So don't smush that.
Looks like we come to the end of our pre-prepared notes, but we have half an hour here for questions. Does anybody have any questions for us? Yes.
I'm about to start a game. I'm a player with a new GM.
Oh.
And
you get to manage up.
And two new characters who have never played before.
So you're the only expert?
The GM has played before, but it's his first time GMing.
Okay.
Is there and we love the adventure paths. Mm-hmm. Is there an adventure path that you would recommend starting out with?
Oh boy. Okay, yes and no. It's a complicated question because an adventure path is a big commitment, right? Like, they can take 2 years to get through. And so if you're playing with a new group, a lot of times people don't know what type of character they like playing. They don't know what type of adventure they like playing. So I like taking one of the old modules that's like a 32-pager, or even one of the free RPG day modules that's only 16 pages. And finding a way to connect that to whatever adventure path I'm going to play as sort of just like an intro to like see if people like it. You know, if people don't like it, if you need to switch out people in your group, if you want people to switch up characters, it's a self-contained, limited sandbox for them to just figure stuff out. And like as far as adventure paths themselves, you're probably going to want to go with one of the APs that's more sort of classic as opposed to one of the weird ones, so you probably don't want to start out with like Iron Gods or something like that.
I can see like Shattered Star is Shattered Star is pretty classic. It's got a lot of dungeon delving and relatively straightforward missions and things like that, but it still has a lot of opportunities for roleplay. You can also when you're trying things out, instead of jumping right into the campaign, do a few like one-shot adventures and things like that. We've got a few Pathfinder Society adventures that are designed with new players in mind. So we have the Confirmation, the Wounded Wisp, and Consortium Compact and First Steps. So if you want to try out like one of those, then that could be another way to go. So how do we do this? And that can give them a chance to try out a few different classes or a few different things to see like, okay, this is, I like playing I like having magic, or like I prefer to have a big sword and smash things. And then once they have a little bit more of that idea, then they can go into the campaign knowing, okay, this is what I want.
But as far as APs themselves, Giant Slayer is super kind of classic sword and board adventuring. Yeah.
I'm ready for experience players, and I got that siege, and I was like,
Rise of the Rune Lords has some sort of horror material in the middle that's not to everybody's taste, but assuming that your group is okay with that, that is kind of our classic, you know, that is our brand, basically. Hell's Rebels, I really liked playing with some new people, and Council of Thieves, you know, people who want to do a more urban, more intriguey campaign was really good, especially if, you know, you have people who are not into classic fantasy and are like, I don't know, I'm not, you know, I didn't like Lord of the Rings. It's like, okay, well, how about we overthrow a government? I mean, my circles, that's, people are like, yes, man the barricades! What else? Yeah.
So, with our PFS community, we have limited time when it comes to our schedule. We get together like 6 on Fridays. The GMs get seated briefly before that, and inevitably, new players will show up usually every week, and I have about 30 seconds to try to tell them, like, here's what we do as a local community. Here's information about Pathfinder. Here's information about Pathfinder Society. Here's the pretense you can pick, blah, 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 blah. I know that this must be a universal, I don't want to say issue, but challenge.
Yep.
So I'm curious if there are any thoughts or ideas that you have to make that easy.
Did you say that the rest of your group is regular?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe talk to your other players for help when new people show up. You know, if they're friendly, if they are good with new people, it doesn't all need to be on the jam. You know, like, I didn't open a core rulebook until I was, like, in session 9 of the first campaign I played because the other people I was playing with were experts and, like, whatever I needed to do, they would tell me. You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to cast a spell. What do I do? And they'd walk me through it. So, I would...
So, okay.
I was just going to say, it can be a collaborative thing, especially since there's times where the GM is, like, talking to one particular player and you're working something out. Somebody else at the table can be, you know, turning to the new person and being like, oh, yeah, you know, what just happened means this. Or, like, this regularly occurring character, this, you know, fictional venture officer, like, here's the history to know on this person. So
I wanted to ask you, is this, are you asking somebody who signed up for the game and is new and is coming there, or are you asking some person in the game store has wandered over and is like, what is this, that thing that is happening on a table?
Yeah, they've heard about Pathfinder Society being played here, and they have shown up when they've been told who to play.
Okay.
And, you know, we have like 6 tables in a room, and we are going at it. So I like your idea of walking them over and saying, hi, this is John. John, this is, you know, new player. This seems like a great table for them to start at. Would you be willing to work with them?
If you got 6 tables, as long it's always a good idea to be offering. So you're generally, I take it then, offering something that the first level character can play and stuff like that. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, social pack, flatter your regular players there. You know, bring them over to the table and be like, these are people who've been playing for a long time. They're experts. They're really great at, you know, explaining stuff to new people. So, and then
and,
they're going to feel obligated to do a good job.
Another thing, too, is that the giant binder of all possible pregens is pretty daunting. So instead of slapping that, I'll be like, okay, you know, do you want to fight up close? Do you want to fight from far away? Do you want to have an animal friend? Do you want to cast spells? Like, you know, if you kind of boil it down to like a few different choices of general theme and then try giving them one of the pregens that's like a little bit on the simpler side for that first game instead of being like, here's the occultist. Enjoy.
The
core ones are really good too because, the core ones are really good too because it's a lot easier, and once they get a core rulebook, they can play that, so you don't have to be like, well, you buy this book here and this book here, then you can play it
there. And even be like, what's your favorite movie character? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if it's Legolas, give them a ranger.
I have a suggestion too. If you make signups for your regular players, when you schedule like a 1-5 tier, you can like leave one seat open, only pre-sign up 5 seats, so that if you're expecting new players, you'll always have an open seat at your tier 1 tier.
I know. That's a really good idea.
And if you do have those players those people who wander by and they're the kind they're looking at it and there's something on the table and they don't really know what that is, but they're kind of hovering nearby and they seem interested, it's a good idea to like, you know, go over and, you know, introduce yourself and sort of explain a little bit what you're doing. You know, they're probably not going to be able to drop everything and join you or whatever, and it would be a little daunting, but like, you know, you're welcome to watch and this is what we're doing and things like that, and that's a good way to bring people in.
Again, we signed up strong enough. We had a large community influx that started at the university, because the university probably runs this one again. That day solely sets on for quests.
Oh, cool.
And the tables are only ever 3 players, like the returning regular players at a GM. So there's always room. obviously, you can't do it to that scale for a game that just had that one table for the replayable. One GM, 3 players, like, God, once every 3 or 4 game days, it's your turn. And they just
A similar model works really well for new GMs too. For a while in the Boston Lodge, we had a thing going where we would have experienced players who, so you would have someone who'd play for a little while and they want to try GMing, but they're not really sure. We'd have like experienced players they were comfortable with be their players and be like, okay, you're running the confirmation for these experienced players. So that anytime they had a question, they would know that everyone would be understanding and they wouldn't have to worry about explaining or teaching anything.
You need to be a little bit careful with that because you need to have the right mix of experienced players for that because you get people who really like to be right that can be off-putting for a new GM. Who, you know, the GM still needs to be in charge even if they're new. So it's a great idea. Just make sure you've got players who are not going to make new GMs feel, you know, like they don't know what they're doing. Or,
We generally have like, you know, we generally have like, you know, a lot of the people now who are like venture captains and venture lieutenants in the region, the people who would be like, okay, yeah, we want to help out with this. And you can see sort of how they play and how they interact with other new players and how that works together for
GMing,
having together tables like that.
GMing for people who usually GM can be really great because at least they understand the pressures that are on the GMs. They understand, you know, some of the difficulties in negotiating who's driving things, and you know, it's a lot of times like people who are really good GMs don't get to play anymore. It's kind of like when you get a job in games, suddenly you barely have any time to play games, right? Like when you're a good GM and people really want you to GM, you don't really get to just be a player. So like that can be something that's really beneficial for both sides, like a group of, you know, venture officers or even just people who have not played in years. What else? Yes?
This is a question for starting at new players. A lot of the time they play this certain type that really wants to go spellcasters first. Do you have any hints on like how to help them like really bootstrap themselves into that more complicated
character? It's good to start with sorcerers so that you don't have to introduce them to the giant list of spells they can prepare. And that way you can sort of be like, okay, you know, these are the first level sorcerer, like, okay, you know the spells, and that those are the things that you can do, and that way it's not as convoluted. So yeah, I would generally suggest starting with spontaneous, and when you start to go with prepared, you can recommend a thing that I think a lot of us do, where you write up a standard list of spells and you take that with you. And then when you're deciding what to prepare, you just modify that a little bit. Or you might have a few where it's like, okay, this is my list of spells for a day I don't think I'm adventuring. This is my list of spells for a day I do think I'm adventuring. And so being able to take the time to come up with that outside of session too, instead of having to worry about that on the fly, and then have those notes just right there with you.
The other thing is I'm going to say yes, direct them towards sorcerer, but some people don't want to, you know, some people are particularly attached to a character concept. Make sure they understand what the different spellcasting classes do mechanically. Like, I played a witch in, I think, my second campaign, and for a long time I felt like, oh, I'm just a nerfed wizard, until I came to understand that what the witch really does is make the GM's life miserable. And then it was like, oh, this is great. But like, you know, going in, have them understand, like, I mean, even the difference between playing a universalist wizard and one that specializes in a school, you know, not what the flavor text in the core rulebook tells you, but like the sort of stepped back in the abstract, like this is what this does. You're a wizard, you know, here's what you're actually going to be good at. If you're a sorcerer, you're basically a wizard for people who don't like as much bookkeeping, you know, clerics, like you are going to be a party healer. If you're not, everybody's going to be mad at you all the time. So
that's a kind of negative energy. There's options there.
Everybody's going to be mad at you all the time. So, yeah.
It's a lot of channel that they might not be as mad at you.
Really? You play a lot of clerics, don't you?
My first character was a cleric.
So, yeah. What else? Really? No questions? All right. In that case,
what time are we at?
That was good. Oh, we've still got 10 more minutes.
Yeah.
All right, well, why don't you tell us what was the hardest thing you, the first time you GM'd? Because it's not just about your players, right? Like, hopefully we're all getting to play in games where we're players, too. I'm like, how do you help a new GM? Anybody? Yeah.
It's not on that subject, but I just wanted to, one thing that, when I'm working with characters, you talk about difficulty and not making it too difficult, and trying to keep the game on track. If someone flubs something really bad, I usually try to say, okay, well, why don't you roll this? Let them roll something else. Kind of like, let them roll until they succeed, just so you have a new player, and they get a natural one or something, their character's going to end up a stain on the floor. That's not fun for anybody, really. And it can really...
You can let them roll until they succeed. There's also ways to make failure fun, right?
Right.
Like, yes, if their character ends up a stain on the floor, that's not fun. If something funny happens to their character that, like, prevents them from doing what they were going to try and do, but, like, ultimately, if you're the GM, you're in control of the world, right, you decide if they die. My first Pathfinder game, Mr. Stevens, our CEO, was the GM. And we've been playing for like 2 years, and she really liked my character, and there came a point where there was an invisible demon in a room, and I just walked into it, and I should have been dead. And in fact, it hit me, and it critted, and I was dead. And she was like, okay, I will deal with you in a moment. Resolves the rest of the round and is like, yes, so you find yourself sucked into, you know, a hell dimension, and describes this, like, both kind of terrifying and hilarious battle that was going on. Like, basically, the forces of heaven had invaded a particular area of hell, and instead of getting killed, I got just sucked into that. And so I did some fast talking to an angel who was taking a breather, and he ended up tossing me back into the back to where I'd been. So, you know, and it ended up being funny, and it ended up just being this cool, like, you know, our adventure was not planar. So it ended up being just this wacky side trip that was super memorable and super fun. So, you know, the fact that they roll a one, the fact that somebody they're fighting crits them, does not, like, if you're the GM, you decide what happens there. So.
And also, like, you know, making sure that the new player understands that you're running the game for them, but you're rooting for them to succeed. You know, so when they do well, that you're like, yeah, and then when they get hit, it's like, oh, that kind of thing. I mean, especially with the new player, not to bring out the sort of the more adversarial stuff. Another fun thing can be, like, if what they roll badly on is something like sense motive, then there's a lot of easy ways to give them something funny that they think. And it's just like, you know, you think that, like, you think that that's your mom, or, like, you think that, like, some ridiculous thing, and then they're sort of like, oh, what are we going to do here? Or, like, if they, one thing that I like to do is, like, if somebody rolls, like, a natural 20 on, like, an attack roll or whatever, be like, all right, and they take out the enemy, it's like, all right, how does it die? You know, that kind of stuff. Give them a chance to, when you know what's going to happen, it's like, okay, you can give them some narrative power.
And I mean, there's a lot of fun ways to make things like skill checks more robust than just you roll a die, you add your bonuses, do you succeed or do you fail? I'll come to my panel later this afternoon on fantasy languages, but just a little spoiler alert, one of the things I like to do with linguistics, and because I'm a language nerd, all of my games have lots of language stuff in them, is if somebody's trying to translate a scroll or understand what somebody uses a language that they have put a rank into, is saying, if they don't roll well, I'll take the information I was going to give them and I will run it through Google Translate like 6 or 7 times, and I will give them the resulting, you know, because, like, if they're smart, they still may be able to figure out some sense of what that means, right? Even after you run it through Chinese and French and German and Arabic and back to English, there's usually some similarity to the original statement. But, like, they're going to have to do some pretty heavy interpretation to get any good information out of it. So instead of just being like, nope, you don't understand, you give them something that like sounds like gibberish but still has a kernel of information there. So make failure fun.
Yes. I'll go ahead and talk on the frustrations for first-time GMing and first-time gamers. When first-time I GM'd game, and also the last time, because it was so traumatic.
Oh no,
sorry. you know, I'm gearing up to do it again.
Okay, good.
It has been about 5 years.
Get back on the horse.
5 years later, here I am. So what happened was, my introduction to gaming as a gamer was through Roll20. I don't know if all of you are familiar. It's an online gaming type of thing where you can see what's going on around you through the internet. Because I was playing with a bunch of fellows in Australia. And our storyteller was wonderful. And he did a great job of pre-generating this whole big, rich world that we could, you know, seriously ask him a question, okay, well, what does the wallpaper look like in X room or X building? And he had it pre-written down. So, you know, he was very detail-oriented. So that's how I sort of grew up in the gaming world. And so by the time I finally got the courage to GM my own world, I spent weeks creating this very detailed, very highly planned out, you know, this area was full of CR3 creatures, this area was full of CR1, etc., etc. And of course, what happened was my gamers, who were also very, very new, they didn't ask those questions.
No.
They just wanted to go and hack and slash, and of course they went into one of these areas where I had CR14s and died.
Oh.
So it was very difficult for me to sort of reconcile, okay, what went wrong,
right?
Yeah. So you can.
Do you understand that what went wrong?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So I mean, it really comes down to flexibility in the world and creating some sort of a, okay, well, I didn't prepare for this, but let's swap that for this right now. So I can come back to the content that I pre-generated with 14 and just ignore that for now.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, of course, how I was going to move forward. But it was very difficult because these gamers also had a bad experience.
Yeah.
And it was just all over here.
It helps to remember that at its best, what we're doing is jazz.
Right? Yeah.
And if you're playing with a bunch of other musicians and one of them decides it's time for a key change, you have to go with them, right? And so, you know, it's like, what I would tell you is if your players want to go in the area where you have CR14 creatures and they're second level, when they head through that doorway, that area magically becomes the area where you have the CR4 creatures, right?
And if you have a reason why you definitely want like the Temple of Doom to have the 14th level characters, there can be a sign outside of it that says like, do not come any closer.
Right.
Giant dragon, it will
right.
eat you, or like guards or NPCs. Like, you know, sometimes if you have to introduce the NPC who comes in and says the obvious thing that the PCs weren't asking, you know, it may not be the ideal situation, but like you can throw that NPC in there and have them say the thing. Or like, oh my goodness, are you actually going to brave the castle that is where the dragon lives, who has slain the last 1,000 adventurers who decided dare to tread upon her halls? And that's like,
or don't
yeah.
be afraid to, at that point, you know, if they insist on, if you have told them that there are CR14 creatures here, and they insist on going to fight them, don't be afraid to, like, as they walk into the battle, there's two level 13 NPCs there that are already fighting these creatures. Or these creatures are wounded, so they can't use most of their special abilities or whatever. You know, there are always ways to ramp that back down.
Or like the creature could always be like, you are not worthy of my attention. You will face my minions.
I'm not gonna fight you.
Yeah.
This is beneath
you. Yeah. I will watch from afar while my minions defeat you. And I was like, ah, my minions
yeah.
fail in war. That right there is what I mostly decided to do with any future encounter of that. But these are great ideas, you know, for ways to either distract, you know. Part of the problem was my new players, they were like, oh, we know magic and no one else in the world does, we're invincible. So they ignored the four warnings that I had.
Yeah.
So.
All right, we've got 2 more minutes. Anybody got something short? Yeah.
I just wanted to say one thing that was a bitter thing for me to learn as a new
GM was the railroading impulse. Like you were saying, I was much like you, a huge detail nerd. I put all kinds of work into like the wallpaper in the chamber and, you know, what languages did the chamberlain speak? And, you know, of course my players would go to right field and say, oh, what's over here? And I'm like, I don't know, you know, and I'd be frozen. And then I'd be like, no, you have to go over here. And they'd be like, no, we want to go over here. No, you have to go over here. And it's, you have to have a certain flexibility, because if you try to force people, then they start feeling like they're NPCs in your story.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's collaborative.
You also have to remember, though, that you control the reality of the world. And if you want them here to go here and fight these kobolds, and they want to go over here and you have not figured out what's in the forest, let them go in the forest, and there are the kobolds.
Right.
Like, they're forest kobolds now.
Yeah.
They're great.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for coming. And for your
thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.